Next case is in the matter of the welfare of the child of M.A.B. The file number is 823-1247. As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. The respondent will have 15 minutes. And then finally, the appellant will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Whenever counsel for the appellant is ready, just approach the microphone, adjust it to your level, and please tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Brooke Beskow-Warg, and I represent appellant M.A.B., who is the grandmother and legal custodian of the child in this matter. Grandmother asked this court to reverse the order transferring permanent legal and physical custody of her grandson to another relative and remand to the district court for further proceedings. The Minnesota Rules of Juvenile Protection Procedure were carefully crafted with the stated purpose of providing a just, thorough, speedy, and efficient determination of each matter and to ensure due process for all those involved in the proceedings. Another stated purpose is to reduce unnecessary delays in the court proceedings. The goal of ensuring speedy and efficient proceedings and reducing unnecessary delays is already incorporated into the rules as written. In other words, when we apply the rules as they are written, we are already proceeding in a way that is most efficient and that was also determined to be the most fair to all the parties involved. In this case, the rules were not followed. Instead—
So is it your point, Ms. Beskow-Warg, that what should have been done was when the denial was entered at the second hearing, a trial should have been scheduled?
At least certainly a pretrial should have been scheduled under the rules as well as a trial. That did not occur here. Instead, the district court accepted the denial, but then proceeded in default at the department's request. This was contrary to the plain language of the rule, which has a plainly stated exception for the admit-deny hearing, where if counsel is present, counsel can enter that denial and then further proceedings are scheduled.
One argument you made, I think in your, I don't know if it was in your prior brief or the principal brief, was that counsel was not able to present any witnesses or present any evidence. Mother could not testify. Was counsel present at this, at the presentation of the state's case during the hearings?
Counsel was there. Counsel was present.
Generally, he could have done something. Right? I mean, he could have, did counsel choose not to present evidence, not to cross-examine the witnesses, not to call any of his own witnesses?
Well, Your Honor, at this stage of the proceedings, what is before the court is the admission or denial. When that denial is entered, we set a scheduling order that, you know, takes care of all the pretrial issues, including trial preparation and discovery
You're right, the court didn't do that. I agree that was error, speaking for myself. But so then we went into a different mode where the court decided it was going to proceed by default, and then the state presented its evidence. And what I'm saying is at that point, if the lawyer was present, couldn't he have done some of the things you're saying your client's right, some of the things that your client was denied the right to do, i.e. cross-examine and just present evidence? I mean, he could have done that, right?
It was she, but
I apologize.
You know, I think there's some conflicting guidance on that exact point. Can counsel for an individual who does not appear, and when the court proceeds in default, can counsel participate in the proceedings and object, call witnesses?
This, reading the transcript, the lawyer did object, had objections sustained even. She didn't cross-examine, although she was not denied the opportunity to. She was asked if she was going to put any evidence on, and she said no. So in fact, what happened was it seems like she was permitted to participate.
Yes. However, at this stage of the proceedings, again, full discovery, there's nothing in the record saying full discovery had been disclosed, that we are at a point where there were pretrial motions or exhibits filed. There was no way for this attorney to be fully and adequately prepared for this hearing to proceed in default, because that's just not what is expected under the rules. That's not how we're supposed to proceed. That is contrary to what is supposed to happen. Hadn't even reached that stage where all of those pretrial preparations had happened and counsel would be fully prepared to present witnesses or present evidence or have exhibits ready to go.
What is the standard? And I know you're familiar with the GAH case recently issued by the Supreme Court. What is the assuming that there was error, what is the standard of prejudice, harmless error, et cetera, that this court should look at? And I also want you to speak to, I think the posture in that case, like in this case, was a denial of a motion for a new trial. In that case, the appellant mother in that case had put in an affidavit proffering testimony on her motion to the district court and also describing the witnesses who would testify on our behalf. Here, you know how limited the motion was for a new trial, which was actually based on a factually inaccurate statement, the refusal of the district court to enter a denial, which was just not the case. So speak to me about what our standard should be in evaluating the impact of the error, and also why that standard is not met here, especially comparing it with what happened in that case.
Sure. So GAH, as this court is aware, was framed as a due process issue based off of the parents' procedural rights in a TPR. This case, it was not framed as a due process issue. We are simply alleging an error of law that resulted in harm to the client here.
So a harmless error is our... for the procedural errors, harmless error. Are you saying, what is the error part of it? Are you saying it doesn't matter whether it was harmful or not? If there's error, full stop, that's the end of it? Or is it a harmless error versus what I presume to be a higher constitutional standard?
So there certainly was error here. I think that is pretty clear. There was an error here. Generally, this court will then assess whether there has been any harm to the individual, the appellant in the case. I submit that there was harm to this client in the case. She was entitled, at a minimum, to a pretrial hearing based off of the rules when her counsel entered that denial on her behalf. She was also entitled to have a trial set where then presumably she could fully contest the evidence. The error is not in whether the outcome of the trial would have been different. It's whether the outcome...
I understand the error. We're assuming the error. How do we measure the harm? How do we measure whether it was harmless? And I'm just asking you, doesn't she need to tell us what she would have done?
Well, and that's essentially what I'm trying to explain, is that it's not the outcome of the trial. She does not need to show that her child would have been returned to her custody. She needs to show that there would have been a different outcome in the proceedings to show that there was harm. The harm here is that she was not given that opportunity for the next hearing that she was entitled to, that pretrial hearing, where any number of things could have happened that could have changed the outcome of this case. There could have been a settlement. She could have decided she still wanted to proceed to trial. There would have been a fuller development of what was going to be before the court, so everyone understood what was going on and what the court possibly could have been considering in this decision.
Ms. Pesco Ward, was following up on Judge Smith's excellent question. So does the record indicate what evidence your client would have liked to have presented at this default hearing, i.e., you know, things are better, you know, no, I really did comply with the case plan? I mean, is there any indication? Because you're saying she's got to prove the outcome would have been different, and I'm saying, how do we know the outcome would have been different if we don't know what she would have liked to have done? I mean, I get the argument about, well, at a pretrial, you know, they would have narrowed the issues, but what evidence would she have liked to have presented that she didn't get to present Or what defense would she like to have presented that she didn't get to present that would have made a difference in the outcome?
So as to your first question, no, she did not offer any evidence in her post-trial motion, anything of that nature. Again, I don't think we get to that piece of the analysis. That's skipping ahead to the outcome of the trial.
I know you don't want to, but you know, again, and getting to Judge Smith's point, it's you know, what would she have liked to have presented that would have changed the outcome had there been a pretrial and a trial? And the answer is?
There was not any evidence submitted in the record. Again, the argument is
but there was an opportunity, as Smith just pointed out. The lawyer was very good at cross-examining and objecting, so presumably, you know, she could have asked for, you know, presented some, you know, called some witness. Who would she have liked to have called? I mean, grandmother was not there, so presumably she wasn't going to come. So was there something else that would have made a difference for your client's case?
Well, and to go back to an earlier point, Your Honor, we hadn't even reached that part of the proceedings. There had not been exhibit lists entered into the record. They had not been exchanged. We still needed to finalize discovery. All of those things needed to happen prior to that pre-trial hearing. We hadn't even gotten to that point yet.
I apologize if I'm interrupting your response. So if you want to complete it, let me just tag on a little bit to Judge Connolly's question. I heard you say that you are not making a due process argument, but the things you're mentioning right now to me sound like a due process argument. And so help me out there. Is that what you intend, that this is not a due process argument? Or are you in fact saying that the denial of, say, notice as to what the county's exhibits would be, notice as to what the witness would be, notice even to the grandmother in this case, that this was not an admit-deny hearing, it was the merits determination on the transfer petition. Is that what you're saying? I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but you said it wasn't due process, and now I hear you arguing. But
sure.
Maybe I misunderstand.
And I completely understand Your Honor's question. This was not framed in the post-trial motion as a due process issue. Certainly it sounds like one and it has all those elements. We are simply asserting that, and certainly if this court wanted to, you know, proceed under a due process analysis, it could probably do that. However—
Well, not without violating the party presentation principle.
Sure, Your Honor.
God forbid we should do that. Having been spanked once on that.
And so this is a violation of the rule that resulted in harm to appellant. She was not able to proceed with the hearing that she was entitled to.
Because counsel was not at that point ready to proceed with trial, or her counsel was not at that point ready to proceed with trial.
Well, and quite frankly, it appears no one was really fully ready to proceed to trial. There weren't any exhibits entered in at the hearing. There was very minimal testimony, very minimal witnesses, which again, I think is reflected in the findings of the court, which are, as this court is aware, the second argument, are wholly inadequate to uphold this transfer of custody.
So as I'm hearing you, I think your distinction from, and I might be helping you out or not, disagree with me is that you need to look at where the error occurred in the process to determine the harm. And in GAH, the error occurred during trial. So they looked at, okay, what's the missing trial testimony? Whereas here it occurred earlier. So you measure harm in a different way from the evidentiary issues. Is that fair to say?
Your Honor, that is exactly right.
Which is what we'll want to hear from, you know, your opposing counsel about.
Yes.
That. Okay.
I think that is exactly right. I think we need to look at the harm that occurred, not based on the outcome of the trial, which, as Your Honor noted, was what happened in GAH. And I discussed this somewhat in my reply brief, that when we are looking at harmless error that occurs during a trial, we are looking at all the evidence and we are deciding whether there was harmless error based on all of that evidence. We can't simply say, well, there was maybe enough evidence, there's maybe sufficient evidence here to sustain this, so the error was harmless. We didn't even get to that point here. The error is not harmless here because she was entitled to further proceedings, and that is where the harm came from in this case.
Even for that, do we need something, an affidavit from, I mean, do we just assume that the lawyer was not prepared to put on? I mean, there was nothing in there to tell us the lawyer hadn't yet prepared witnesses, didn't have exhibits, et cetera.
Well, I think the record is pretty clear that none of that was filed into the court record. So I don't know that we need an affidavit saying that we weren't ready to proceed. Under the rules, everyone walks into this hearing, and I think that's general practice, that we walk into this hearing expecting to address whether there's an admission or a denial and not moving any further. Either there's an admission and that's the end of it, or there's a not a denial and we move on to further proceedings. That is what attorneys expect walking into this hearing. That is what they advise their clients of, and that's what we are told is supposed to happen under the rules. When we don't follow those rules, we undermine the process, and everyone, quite frankly, loses trust in that process. And that is very problematic. I see my time is just about up, so I'll answer any further questions on rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll now hear from counsel for the respondent, please.
Good morning, Your Honors and counsel, and may it please the court. My name is Britta Nicholson, and I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney in the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. I'm appearing today on behalf of the respondent in this case, who is the Hennepin County Human Services and Public Health Department, who I will be referring to as the department throughout oral argument this morning. I would like to begin by addressing an argument that was raised at the beginning of oral argument today, but also in appellant's reply brief, that the error in this case was prejudicial because it prohibited appellant from challenging the department's evidence in any way. However, that is not the case if you look at the record. If the Court of Appeals accepts appellant's argument that her CHIPS counsel represented her on the TLC petition and therefore had standing to enter that denial, appellant's attorney remained in the room during the entire default and had the opportunity to challenge the department's evidence. After every witness who testified, and there were three of them, if you look at the transcript, the district court asked appellant's counsel if she would like to cross-examine the witness. Appellant's counsel declined every time. And then after the department rested, the court asked if she wanted to be heard on anything at that time. Appellant's counsel again declined. And appellant's counsel did object to the county attorney's request to take judicial notice of the entire file, and that objection was successful, and the scope of the judicial notice was narrowed by the district court. And then finally, the court gave appellant's counsel the opportunity to either submit her own proposed findings after the default or to object to the department's proposed findings following the default. All of these are examples.
Did the district court specifically ask counsel, would you like to call any of your own witnesses?
Nope, she did not ask that. And that is because it wasn't a trial. It was default proceedings. And if you look at the plain language of the rule, Rule 18 states that during a default, the court may receive evidence in support of the petition.
But I mean, isn't that, you're right. But, you know, you're allowed to go to default when the client has received notice of the trial. I mean, here, there was no notice of the trial. There was notice there was going to be a continued admit-deny hearing. So I'm not so sure that works. But, I mean, what about Ms. Nicholson? You know, if counsel for the client was expecting, well, this is just going to be another admit-deny hearing, how, I mean, and then you go to trial or you go to this hearing, default hearing, who would be prepared to do anything if you didn't think that was going to happen? So, I mean, isn't there some prejudice there?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Why
the
not?
Text of Rule 18 notes that defaults aren't only for trials. They are for admit-deny hearings. They are for pretrial hearings. At any stage in the proceeding, a parent can be defaulted. And in the hearing notices that a parent
right,
receives.
Right, but at that point, the lawyer it denied on behalf of the client.
Correct.
So, which is possible, correct?
Correct.
So why then wasn't the next step to set it for pretrial or trial? Why go straight into this procedure?
And that goes back to the argument I made in my brief about whether or not appellant's counsel actually had the legal standing or authority to enter denial to the permanency petition when she, in fact, had not been appointed on the permanency file. However, if the court does agree that she did have the legal standing to enter that denial at that time, I would concede that the court's best practice would have been to proceed with setting the pretrial. And that's not what happened.
Is it best practice, or would it actually violate the rule?
I do believe if you look at the language of the BEM case, which did interpret Rule 18, then yes, it would have been an error to proceed. But again, that's assuming that this court agrees that counsel did represent appellant on that permanency petition when appellant had never in fact appeared on that permanency petition to have the right to counsel attach on that petition. She could not have requested counsel because she had never appeared on that petition. So from my interpretation of the record, appellant was only appointed on the CHIPS file and was not appointed on, sorry, appellant's counsel was appointed on the CHIPS file, not the completely new and separate permanency file. So she did actually not have the authority to enter a denial on appellant's behalf when she did not represent appellant on that transfer of custody petition. And then in that case, we would look to the case law that states that the Court of Appeals will not reverse a correct decision simply because it is based on incorrect reasons, or if the Court of Appeals would have reached the same result on different grounds. And the case is in the matter of the welfare of the child of AH, 879 Northwest 2nd 1, that's from the Minnesota Court of Appeals in 2016. So even though the district court incorrectly acted as if counsel had been appointed on the TLC petition in this case and then proceeded with the default under a different rationale, that is not a basis for reversal here because the correct result was ultimately reached, which was defaulting the grandmother in this case because she did not have appellant counsel appointed on that petition who could have entered a denial to the petition. I would also like to address the harmless error arguments that were brought up during oral argument. On appeal, it is not enough, and the case law is clear about this, it is not enough to claim that an appellant was prejudiced merely because they were not allowed to present evidence. An appellant must show that their evidence was likely to change the outcome of the case. And in this case, appellant's counsel, both in post-trial motion and now here on appeal, have not made any claim or showing about what type of evidence appellant would have presented if the district court had set a pretrial and then a trial, and if a contested trial had happened.
The case law that you're referring to, and this might be, well, you know the cases you briefed. I assume that that description you gave came out of a case where there was a trial. I'm wondering whether you have any, or if not, tell me that. Is there case law where there was a complete absence of a trial that was in error? Let's assume error, because we're into the prejudice aspect of it. Should have gone to trial, it didn't. Where the person needs to put forth proffer the evidence.
So I cited in my brief the II case. That is a 2019 Westlaw 2263515 from the Court of Appeals in 2019. And in that case, there was a default termination of parental rights. The appellant was raising due process claims regarding the default proceedings, but the Court of Appeals affirmed the default TPR because there was no prejudice to appellant and this is quoting the opinion, when the record strongly suggests that appellant is not fit to fulfill the duties of a parent, it is apparent that even if the district court had conducted additional proceedings with additional procedures, the county would have prevailed and appellant's parental rights would have been terminated. And then I also have here, in the MH case, 2015 Westlaw 113098, and that was due process claims regarding default proceedings, and noting that appellant failed to demonstrate any prejudice from the alleged violation of her due process rights because she made no argument that the district court's factual findings are incorrect or that the outcome of the case would have been different without the alleged violation. And then another case was HEA, 2023 Westlaw 5525070, and that is dealing with due process arguments regarding defaults proceedings. And then appellant does not argue, let alone demonstrate, that the outcome of the proceedings would have been different if they would have been present. So I think the case law is clear that you have to focus on whether the outcome of the case would have been different. If the district court would have said, all right, I accept your denial, let's set a pretrial and a trial, and then if the case went to trial down the line and appellant presented evidence, would this have resulted in reunification? And in this case, the record is abundantly clear that it would have not. And in addition, appellant has failed to meet her burden to show prejudice by demonstrating what type of evidence she would have presented if she had been allowed to go to trial down the line, and even if she had presented evidence, whether it would have affected the outcome of this case.
May counsel ask you, since you're obviously familiar with these cases that you've just cited to us, do they involve a parallel situation where the default occurred at the admit denial? Because I heard Judge Smith's earlier question. I thought it was a good one about whether we evaluate prejudice in light of the stage of proceedings at which default is applied. And if we do, it becomes very important. You know, you've referred generally to default proceedings, as we've all recognized there are many stages at which default can occur, and this happened at a particularly early stage in the transfer petition.
Correct. So the cases I cited, I don't believe are an exact mirror to the facts of this case, where it was appellant, again, if you accept that appellant counsel represented the client on the permanency petition, that appellant attempted to enter a denial. However, the case that has those facts is the BEM case, which is cited by appellant. But even in that case, the Court of Appeals was very clear that prejudice is a key part of the analysis. In BEM, the default wasn't just reversed solely because the court improperly improperly allowed the default when an appellant's counsel asked to enter a denial. The reversal was additionally based on the second required step of the analysis, that the error caused prejudice in that case. And in that case, they found prejudice because the district court did not receive any sworn testimony or documentary evidence in support of the default. And that is a very stark contrast to this case, when the court received sworn testimony from three witnesses and took judicial notice of a number of documents from the court file. And then the court went above and beyond in this case by allowing the appellant's counsel the opportunity to cross-examine witnesses, the opportunity to object to judicial notice, the opportunity to challenge any proposed findings. In this case, those same concerns that resulted in prejudice in BEM are just plainly not here in this case. But the BEM case does stand for the fact that even if there was a violation of Rule 18, that doesn't end the analysis. The court still needs to take the next step and determine whether that error caused prejudice to the appellant.
All of those non-precedential decisions, II, et cetera, are those all cited in your brief?
II was cited in my brief.
Okay. I was just looking at II, which looks like, maybe I have the wrong one, but I'll double check, where it looks like we found no violation. I'm not seeing the prejudice analysis. In other words, I'm seeing that the default was not a violation of due process, but maybe we'll double check that.
I believe they, I don't know if they found a due process violation, but they also went to the next step and did the prejudice analysis by saying, even if there had been a violation, there would have been no prejudice because the outcome would have been the same.
Ms. Nicholson, getting to appellant's second argument as to the sufficiency of the findings, you know, in looking at the district court's order number 11, Ms. Laskowski has not maintained consistent contact with a social worker, has not substantially complied with a court-ordered case plan, has not corrected the conditions that led to out-of-home placement, and has not maintained regular visitation with the child. See Krenzel testimony. You know, one thing that we normally see in orders like this is, well, here, the case plan asked her to do X, Y, and Z, and she didn't do X, Y, and Z. So why isn't number 11 rather conclusory, particularly since it says, you know, see Krenzel testimony? I mean, I have to admit, that's a new one. I never really have seen, like, I mean, normally you see the findings, you know, she was supposed to get regular UAs and she didn't show up for the UAs and et cetera, et cetera. So why is that finding, how do we know as a reviewing court whether that's right or not? Number 11.
So the district court does cite, it did find Ms. Krenzel's testimony credible and persuasive as noted in paragraph 4. And then the district court directly
cited. Yeah, but her testimony as to what?
regarding the contact with the social worker, the compliance with her court-ordered case plan, and whether or not she corrected the conditions that led to the out-of-home
placement. Do we even know what the case plan required her to do based on this order?
Your Honor, the court took judicial notice of all of the former orders in the court file. That includes the CHIPS adjudication order, which clearly outlines the elements of her case plan and what was court ordered. And when Ms. Krenzel testified, she further testified to the elements of the appellant's court ordered case plan. The district court's order does not need to necessarily copy and paste items that were of judicial notice or regurgitate the testimony. In fact, appellant has cited many cases where she claims that that's an error for the district court to basically repeat testimony from the trial in the order. The court's job is to reach conclusions based on the evidence, and that is what the district court did in this case. The district court reached a number of conclusions in paragraph 11 and said that it was supported and based on the testimony of Ms. Krenzel, who the court found credible and persuasive. And then on appeal, the Court of Appeals is able to look at what evidence the district court relied on, that it found credible, persuasive, and turn to the transcript itself and find support in Ms. Krenzel's testimony for all of those conclusions in paragraph 11.
I'm sorry. So with respect to the case plan and reasonable efforts, because paragraph 10, like you would have to agree, I assume, just essentially restates the statutory definition of what's reasonable, what efforts are reasonable. Paragraph 11 talks about the case plan. You're asking us to, I guess, infer that that means that the efforts are reasonable. That's in the case plan, the efforts that are reflected in the case plan. So for that, as a reviewing court, we're supposed to assume that the case plan was among the orders of which judicial notice was taken and go into that file, which is separate. It's not our file on appeal. It's the Chips case, as you know, you talk about being a separate case. And then there, we determine that what the efforts were.
Ms. Krenzel testified about her reasonable efforts and the efforts of the social workers that preceded her on the case, including their efforts to email. They emailed Ms. The appellant a copy of the case plan. Ms. Krenzel made efforts to send her text messages that she could see were read, but that appellant never responded to. They discussed how Ms. Krenzel attempted to explain to her the concept of a chemical dependency assessment, but the appellant disagreed with her case plan. In Ms. Krenzel's testimony, there is ample evidence regarding reasonable efforts. And in addition, the judicial notice rule does allow the court to take judicial notice of documents in this file and related court files, which would be the CHIPS file, which is what this court did. So that does give this court the latitude to go into the CHIPS file, look at the CHIPS adjudication order, and also look at items like the permanency progress review order, which made findings regarding the department's reasonable efforts to date. And in addition, as I pointed out in my brief, there is a published Supreme Court case that allows this court to rely on the permanency petition. And that petition includes extensive details regarding the case plan, the department's reasonable efforts, and appellant's failure to comply with her case plan. And with that, I do see that my time is up.
Did you have another question, Judge Smith?
Just if you don't mind. Go right ahead. Thank you. Just one thing. On the petition, now, it looks like the district court, there was an objection to considering everything in the petition in this case. And district, am I wrong about that? What is it that the district court said, no, I'm just going to take judicial notice of the orders?
So the county attorney asked the district court to take judicial notice of absolutely everything in the court file. And that would include things such as pre-hearing reports, court notifications, documents that were confidentially filed about the child's therapy or things like that. And the appellant's counsel objected and said that's not what the rule states. The district court agreed and stated that it was allowed to take judicial notice of orders and findings from this file and related files. So that's what the court took judicial notice of. There was no specific
argument regarding the petition. Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Nicholson. Ms. Beskow-Warg, you'll have the last word, please.
I'd like to at least briefly address counsel's argument that counsel was not appointed for appellant in this matter. I believe that argument is completely without merit. Everything in the record suggests that everyone knew that she was counsel, that the court recognized her as counsel for appellant. She was served with the petition. She is recognized in MGA as counsel for appellant. Appellant has a right to counsel under the statute currently. To say that she was not appointed is a technical error that only further prejudices appellant in this case, and it should not be considered. It was also not raised to the district court. It was raised for the first time here on appeal and should not be considered for that reason. I'd also like to address the BEM case. That is the case where this court reversed and remanded under similar circumstances at a TPR hearing where the denial was entered at the admit deny and they still proceeded in default. One notable difference about that case is it did not squarely address where that harm needed to occur, as Judge Smith asked in her question, and I submit needs to occur before we get to the actual evidence and the default proceeding itself and the outcome of that hearing. Instead, it looked to the procedures that were utilized at that hearing and determined that those were insufficient and said those two errors, proceeding in default inappropriately or impermissibly, and then also having an improper procedure at that hearing resulted in that reversal. It did not squarely address where that harm needed to occur, and I again argue that it needs to be assessed in light of where we are at in the proceedings, which is at the admit-deny hearing. So that is very different. One note on the judicial notice, what's concerning here is that yes, the court took judicial notice. We do not know what the court exactly took judicial notice of. I believe the case DJN, that's 568 Northwest 2nd 170, says that the parties need to be aware of what is being taken judicial notice of so that they can adequately contest any of that evidence. Here, we don't know what it was. We don't know what the court actually relied on. And because the findings are deficient, we cannot assess what the court relied on in making those findings. So that too is problematic.
Go ahead, Judge.
Well, my question is really not directly relevant here, but it is in terms of your request for a remand, I think it's relevant. So say we do view prejudice in the way that you're asking us to, which is to look at it in light of the procedure. And so this case is sent back for what, a new admit deny proceeding? Is that what you're asking? Or an admit, the denial has been entered, so now it would be sent back for scheduling for, I heard you ask for a pretrial and trial.
Correct.
So what happens under the rules if grandmother continues to default? We have continue to have separate default proceedings, but they're always, it's a default of whatever was given notice. So a default on the pretrial, a default on the trial, and otherwise things proceed.
Well, under the rules, default at a pretrial hearing, if a parent or a legal custodian does not show up at that hearing, is permissible. And so there would not be, I guess, an issue there unless there were other issues that arose within that proceeding that maybe warrant an appeal. But if she were to not show up at that pretrial hearing, assuming this was reversed and remanded and sent back for that pretrial hearing, default could happen at that hearing. That would be permissible.
Same for trial. I mean, that's obviously important, right? If a notice is given for trial, the trial is set, grandmother doesn't show up, but she's represented by counsel at the proceeding, the county can ask to proceed in default.
That's correct. All right. At pretrial or at trial, but not at the admit deny under the rules. That is not permissible. I see my time is just about up, so unless there are any other questions, I would just like to close and reiterate that the rules in these proceedings matter, and they must be applied fairly and consistently to all of these hearings, otherwise they are meaningless. Because the district court proceeded in default and clear violation of the rules and denied grandmother the right to a pretrial hearing and potentially a fully contested trial on the merits, we ask this court to reverse the transfer of custody order and remand to the district court for further proceedings. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The matter was well argued and well briefed. We will issue our decision within the statutory time frame. And Ms. Beska-Warg, please give my warmest regards to Jeanette Berner.